is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. We begin with a question.
Who won the Civil War?
Now that's Courtney Plunk. Back in 2014, Plunk was a student at Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas, playing the part of a roving reporter to discover what her fellow students knew about American history and politics.
Who won the Civil War?
Who won the Civil War?
We did? The South?
Like the one in 1965 or what Civil War?
Who won it?
Who was even in it?
Who was in it? Just tell me who was in it.
Ooh, I don't know.
Why you making me do this?
Who won the Civil War? Yeah.
Oh my God. Hey, I'm drawing a blank. It's one of those things.
I feel like I'm on the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
America? I don't know.
That's the Confederates, right?
Dang it.
I have no clue.
The Union. The North. Yes. Okay.
Okay, right. Painful. But the video was an instant internet sensation. But as entertaining and, yes, horrifying as these kinds of person-on-the-street interviews or student-on-the-quad interviews can be, they can't reliably capture the full landscape of American civic knowledge. But unfortunately, in 2014, Texas Tech student responses were uncomfortably close to the dismal state of American political knowledge. The Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania has conducted the Civics Knowledge Survey since 2006. And typically, the results show just how little basic information Americans can recall about our nation and its political processes. In 2016, just prior to the election that put Donald Trump in the White House, only a quarter of Americans could name all three branches of government. And this was, quote, the poorest showing on that question in a half dozen years. And, quote, nearly a third of Americans cannot name any of the three branches of government. But take heart, dear listener, all is not lost. After bottoming out 5 years ago, something rather stunning happened. American civic knowledge improved, in fact, rather dramatically. In 2020, nearly three quarters of Americans correctly named freedom of speech as one of the rights guaranteed under the First Amendment. Also in 2020, more than half of those surveyed accurately named all three branches of the federal government, the largest percentage of Americans giving the right answer in the history of the survey. Everybody, so just how did American civic knowledge improve so rapidly? There's no way to know for certain, but it is reasonable to think that more Americans could identify free speech as a First Amendment right in 2020 because media regularly discussed ideological tensions on college campuses as debates about free speech. Now, as for the much higher percentage of Americans who understood the three branches of government, well, it's worth noting that the impeachment of President Trump by the U.S. Congress dominated political news from late 2019 through the first third of 2020. Nothing like a little impeachment trial to tone up on that separation of powers clarity. So if high-profile public battles about free speech and presidential accountability led to a marked improvement in civic knowledge, what might be the outcome of the recent pitched battles in state legislatures about critical race theory curriculum? Listen to what some state legislators across the country had to say this spring.
A teacher may not teach that one race is inherently superior to another race.
There are those that believe that certain segments of our society cannot advance because of racism, that the system has to be modified or torn down.
You see it across the country. I mean, it is tearing communities apart. It's wrong. It should not be taught in schools.
I mean, how would anyone have a problem with this? It's amazing.
Okay, I see what y'all are trying to do here, but guys, shh. You might just manage to create a nation of novice critical race theorists. We're joined now by Dr. Prudence Carter, professor and outgoing dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley, where she focuses on race, class, gender, and education inequality. She's the author of Stubborn Roots, Race, Culture, and Inequality in the U.S. and South African Schools, and recently she became president-elect of the American Sociological Association. Professor Carter, it is so great to have you back on the show.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, for the uninitiated or those who may think they're initiated but are not, can you tell us what is critical race theory?
Well, Melissa, to be honest with you, I didn't know what critical race theory was until I started working on my PhD and was in graduate school. It is a theoretical framework that was created and developed by legal scholars. It comes out of critical legal studies in the 1970s, 1980s. It developed and spread into other areas like education and other social sciences. And essentially what critical race theory does is try to show how race and racism can still be found, can still be promulgated in policies and politics and laws in our society. Even if they seem facially neutral, they can actually engender disparities among races so that those who have been historically minoritized and disadvantaged, like Black, Brown, and other people of color, can still be disadvantaged. It centers structural racism. It centers how white privilege and white supremacy manifest themselves even through our political, social, and economic institutions.
Now, I want to go to that point that you made about learning it in grad school. I think that's when I certainly used the language of CRT for the first time or, you know, was introduced to it in a classroom. Is anybody teaching critical race theory in like third grade?
Well, that's what's actually quite humorous and actually sad about this. I would love to know which elementary and middle schools are teaching critical race theory, and for that matter, high schools are teaching critical race theory. It suggests to me that what we might be talking about is a straw man in American education, both K-12 and higher education. Certainly, there are some undergraduate courses where there may be a reference to critical race theory, but it is something that many of us have learned in graduate school. And I wonder if this is really about the fear of teaching about race in a more critical and incisive way in American schooling.
I mean, indeed, it feels like it must be about that, right? I mean,
yes.
And I guess part of what I've been wondering, and as I started this segment in our conversation, I'm wondering if it might actually have a backfiring effect. So again, our American civic knowledge is really like shamefully low. And yet when we see things that come into the news, like free speech or the separation of powers, then suddenly actually Americans are able to identify and apply those basic concepts more accurately. I'm wondering if that might also happen, not only with actual critical race theory, but simply with discussions of race, that in fact, conservative legislators might be doing the opposite of what they think they're doing.
Well, certainly if you look through history around the prohibition of various things in our society, what they do is cultivate interest in that which has been stigmatized or denied. And so you may actually have more people going to do the research to figure out really what is this big bad wolf that these legislators are talking about. And certainly if you look at Google searches, they have increased exponentially as people are trying to teach themselves about what critical race theory is. What is all of this controversy about? So it's possible that there could be more underground movements, or there could be actually more study groups, consciousness raising groups, as people try to work outside the bounds of not the narrow bounds of knowledge that these laws are producing.
My dad used to put the books that he most wanted us to read on a shelf that said, "Don't read these books." And of course, what would we do as soon as he was gone? We'd read those books.
That's right.
But I'm wondering how we might be able to fit this into a broader set of concerns that have been bipartisan and cross-ideological, about what it is Americans do need to know about our history and about how our political systems work.
Well, you know, it is the case that knowledge is socially constructed and it can be politically bounded. What this current state shows us is that politics and may infuse what students are learning. Political ideology shapes what we learn. And that has been the case throughout human history. What I find a bit difficult about these particular laws is that instead of saying, here's a framework that could be critiqued or problematized, and we can juxtapose that next to other understandings of history, and then to teach students critically how to discern or go between them, it's just being thrown out as you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And so it is a narrowing of history in critical ways. One of my main concerns is, particularly since we've just celebrated Juneteenth on Saturday, is how educators are supposed to actually teach and celebrate a federal holiday, but they can't talk about its historical origins in the most penetrating ways. So there are some contradictions here, Melissa. There is also little guidance for educators about what they can and cannot talk about because the definitions of critical race theory are now so vague in these state laws.
I guess even hearing you say that sentence, educators being told what they can and cannot talk about, just seems so, and perhaps this is the privilege of the academy itself, but it seems so surprising to me as a way to think about how we would want any set of topics addressed within American public education. Isn't it sort of the, I don't know, curricular ideal to have this free exchange of ideas?
In our nation, historically, we've said we are a country of freedom of expression. We are a country where we are trying to produce the most critical thinkers and promoting individualism, having a tolerance for a variety of ideas. But what these laws do is actually contradict and countervail those very principles. So it is the case that we have some academic freedom being in many ways suppressed by these new laws in these various states. I would not be surprised if we see a number of lawsuits ensue, particularly because some of these lawsuits are reaching into higher education. It is the case in public and K-12 education that states have more jurisdiction and can govern the standards of curriculum. But in higher education, there is a lot more academic freedom, particularly for scholars and researchers and professors. So there is a narrowing and a tailoring here. It is antithetical, in my opinion, to the various principles and tenets of freedom of expression, freedom of thought that we espouse to believe in this country.
Professor Carter, let me step back a little bit to exactly this point about the politics of curriculum. Mm-hmm. If we look back in sort of American history, maybe back to the 1920s when we're first beginning to have a generalized public school system, what was its goal? What were we hoping to do with public school?
So, to be clear, I am not a historian of education, but from what I know from teaching and bringing together history in various forms, let's be real about the massification of education and its relationship to the development of the American economy. And a large part of this was the realization of many employers and large corporate owners about the need for literacy and numeracy skills to have better informed, better educated workers. And so the opening up of schools was really driven a large part by the needs and the demands of the economy. And that did spread. It spread in a separate and not even an equal way. Then you had the massive migration and immigration of various Southern and Eastern European groups, as well as migrants, the great migration of those who were the descendants and those who were formerly enslaved to the Northern and Rust Belt cities. So a large part of this was about understanding that there needed to be some education, as particularly as we moved into the periods and the eras of the wars and needed educated populace.
So building on that, I'm thinking about the world we now live in, which for American workers is much less likely to be a world of manufacturing, much more likely to be a world of ideas. And in fact, to the extent that we think of it as an entire world, a quite diverse world of ideas.
That's right.
Wouldn't this suggest that some versions of even the kind of mischaracterized critical race theory, but understanding race and its role in our history would be valuable for the workforce that we're now creating?
There are a couple of points here, Melissa. Another part of the massification of education was also to socialize. Education is a socializing institution to make sure that you could create citizens and patriots because you had these immigrants, people coming from different parts of the world, and that they could all cohere around certain fundamental tenets. You move to this kind of the more contemporary period, we have increasingly become more diverse, a more open society, and part of the push in the 1960s and the 70s and 80s was about a deeper inclusion and a widening of an expansion of knowledge because our society has become so much more diverse. But the problem is social psychologists are showing, and I'm thinking the work of Jennifer Richardson and Maureen Craig, they're showing that the more diverse we become, the less tolerant particularly whites become in their attitudes about the inclusion of these groups. Meanwhile, part of having this openness, a multicultural movement, is also about trying to maintain the legitimacy of the American Republic, of the United States of America, as a place of freedom and justice and liberation. So it's really hard to see how we can maintain that identity or even grow it if we're going to have a narrow construction of what it means to be a nation.
Indeed, I think of Baldwin saying that we can understand his love for the nation, his patriotism, in his willingness to critique the nation. That is actually the evidence of the love, the commitment to the national notions, our kind of aspirational best ideas of who we can be. It actually requires that we critique that we are not yet that.
That's exactly right. And another part of it is, just let's just be honest about it, is that all of human history is about some form of subjugation. So there is that logic that's embedded in these laws, which we don't want individuals or groups to feel badly. I can't imagine any aspect of human history that hasn't been about some form of subjugation, from imperialism to colonialism, settler colonialism, colonization, wars, religious conflict. Everything has been, sociologically speaking, about groups subjugating, subordinating, marginalizing, oppressing others. If you use this logic that's currently at play now, it means in theory that you couldn't teach any history. If you think about it. The logic is flawed. And it's also a second point is it erases. We spent a large part of time trying to educate, if you want, an educated populace. Presumably, as we gather more knowledge and discover more things, you share it with the people. Why would you actually legalize or sanction not telling the truth?
Is it a version of book burning?
It is. In some ways, it's a modern day form of it. But it's not unlike, though, the struggles, the curricular and political debates around creationism, right, and evolution. This is how we know education as a social institution is a political institution. It is a social institution. It's constructed. And these lawmakers are trying to create the bounds of knowledge today, very narrowly.
Indeed, in some ways, the attack is the thing that lets you know it's worth the fight.
Exactly.
Very swiftly, what do you think classrooms will look like in September, in the fall, as compared to what they do right now in these states that have passed these laws?
Well, I'm very concerned, particularly about the lack of guidance for educators, particularly teachers in social studies and civics classes, because as I mentioned earlier, the laws are vague. I've spent a lot of time trying to understand exactly how they define CRT, and there is no definition, really. There are just these different kind of vague and broad swipes about what things are going to do. So it's the question of whether or not teachers can actually talk about race. They can talk about white privilege and white supremacy. Can they talk about slavery and the brutality of the peculiar institution? These are the questions.
Prudence Carter is a professor and outgoing dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. Next month, she'll be a professor of sociology at Brown University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Those are the unmistakable rhythms of Double Dutch, the skill that generations of young Black girls in cities have perfected and passed on. Double Dutch is low cost, it's collaborative, and it requires great communication. In other words, Double Dutch is a Black girl solution to the reality that so few institutions took note of or invested in the specific needs of Black girls. Philanthropy continues to underinvest in Black girls. In 2017, less than 1% of the $67 billion in foundation contributions went to organizations focused on women and girls of color. And that's according to a report from the Ms. Foundation for Women. But once again, Black girls and women are innovating their own solutions. And here to help us learn a little philanthropic Double Dutch is Dr. Monique W. Morris, President and CEO of Grantmakers for Girls of Color. Dr. Morris, it's always great to speak with you.
So great to be here. I'm really thrilled to have this conversation with you today.
So talk to me a little bit about what Grantmakers for Girls of Color is.
Thank you. As you mentioned, there has been a very poor, woeful underinvestment in the well-being of girls of color generally. Research from that same Ms. Foundation report that you just cited from showed that as of 2017, less than 15 million was noted as benefiting Black women and girls specifically. So Grantmakers for Girls of Color is seeking to be a remedy in this space. We serve as an anchor, funneling and facilitating resource exchanges from donors, grantee partners, movement leaders, advocates and organizations in multiple directions. And crucially, I will say, our work revolves around a deep engagement, learning, and listening with youth. We see, you know, philanthropy through a lens of reciprocity, intersectionality, and cultural responsiveness, not just as a framework, but as a praxis, really. We draw on cultural traditions of communities of color that invite complexity, reciprocity, accountability, and we sustain community and make investments that are, you know, material, spiritual, emotional, and intellectual. So we act as an intermediary to help uplift and organize and mobilize resources to support movements that are specifically engaged in working with and for girls of color broadly. And we have some specific funds that wrap themselves around the identities of some of our youngest folks in crisis.
So let's back up just a bit. What is it that philanthropy does within the context of social justice movements? Why should we care if there's philanthropic dollars for any particular set of concerns?
Philanthropy is a significant mobilizer. I would say it's really important for us to care what philanthropy does because philanthropy is resourcing movements and helping to direct those actions that inform how we engage in a community, articulating justice, articulating what is well-being, and articulating and moving and actively mobilizing within our communities. The thing about it, and the reason why I started by saying that we engage reciprocity in our notion of philanthropy is that communities have always been involved in philanthropy of some sort, right? You know, we think about philanthropy as this sort of distant way of engaging that is primarily about the wealth of a very small group of people. But really, if we broaden our perspective about what philanthropy is and what it means to give and what it means to give with love and engage in this notion of building together and working toward a better community, then we'll recognize that there were multiple ways that our ancestors, grandmothers, grandfathers participated in philanthropy that sometimes didn't involve money, that sometimes involved the exchange of resources.
What's crazy is that there are 300 girls in this school. Good majority of girls here are Black, and they go through a lot. And I know they go through a lot because they're Black. They live in America.
That's Emma. She's one of the Black schoolgirls featured in the documentary Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in America. So you were saying that we need to expand our notion of philanthropy and also of reciprocity. And it made me think of the work that you did in Push Out, listening very carefully to young women like Emma.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I think that the work that we do is all connected, right? The work that we do to amplify and engage girls as co-constructors of not just our understanding of what is possible in their lives, but also how we should be resourcing what is possible in their lives is critical to this work. So, you know, at Grantmakers for Girls of Color, you know, we serve as philanthropic educators, if you will, organizing foundations and donors and other co-investors to mobilize resources. We recently joined a force of Black women calling for a $1 billion investment in the well-being of Black girls through the Black Girl Freedom Fund and the $1 billion for Black Girls campaign. You know, we support organizations that are serving Black girls and other girls of color directly through grant making, but also through capacity building, which is important for our organizations and especially important for those organizations that are working with and on behalf of Black girls and other girls of color. Our Love is Healing Fund, which we launched last June, has distributed nearly $4 million to more than 168 organizations in nearly 35 states, Washington, D.C., Guam, and Puerto Rico, you know, since 2020. And our Black Girl Freedom Fund just made the announcement that we are resourcing our first $600,000 to six Black-led wellness and safety organizations serving Black girls.
So take an example like the Black Girl Freedom Fund and these dollars that will go to questions of wellness and Black women-led organizations. How do you know if your dollars are making a difference?
We know that our dollars are making a difference because we've worked with our organizational grantee partners to co-construct measures of success that include specific metrics around how they articulate justice and wellness, but also how we are understanding from the girls themselves that this is necessary work. All of our work is co-constructed with girls. So we have youth advisory groups that work with us that help with the decision-making around who gets resourced and what is getting resourced. So we really trust the leadership of Black girls in this work. And in the trusting of Black girls in this work, that tells us so much of what we need to know about whether this is working, because they not only are truth tellers, but they can also help us design specific, specific metrics that we can use then to translate these bits of information to philanthropy, our co-investment partners, and the public at large. And so we know that ultimately this will make a difference when we see a transformation of outcomes for Black girls. And when we're not only talking about Black girls through a lens of deficit, but when we understand that a deep investment in their joy and well-being is part of how we construct this narrative about Black girlhood, right? The work of push out, the work to end push out, and the work to engage girls in helping us better understand what educational systems look like for them taught me a lot about how we should be engaging with young people, how our organizations should be responsive, what it means to engage and practice intersectionality beyond just as a framework, but as a real practice in how we are engaging young people and mapping the margins and doing what we've been invited to do in this grand scheme of social and racial justice. You know, for us, racial justice and the deep investment in racial justice needs to have a strong gender lens, and that in order for us to fully engage in conversations, in, you know, the narrative development around this work, that it has to be co-constructed with girls. So we take that very seriously and have moved to operationalize that in our work, in our distribution of scholarship, our distribution of resources, and also, just how we talk about this in general.
Dr. Monique W. Morris is the president and CEO of Grantmakers for Girls of Color. Dr. Morris, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa Harris-Perry.
Take a listen to this moment from our national history.
While I advocated violent self-defense, because I don't think you can really have a defense against violent racists and against terrorists unless you're prepared to meet violence with violence.
That was Robert Williams speaking in a clip from an award-winning documentary titled Negroes with Guns. And although he's rarely taught in the civil rights curriculum of public schools, Williams is a bit of a legend here in North Carolina. Williams was living in Monroe, North Carolina in the 1950s after returning home from fighting in World War II. The KKK was engaged in relentless campaigns of violence and intimidation against Black neighborhoods in Monroe, and in response, Williams organized a local chapter of the NAACP. And he sought and received a charter from the NRA, thus founding the Black Armed Guard. Williams and the Black Armed Guard successfully defended their community against terror, they protected civil rights workers, and they produced public information through Radio Free Dixie. All are activities presumably protected by the U.S. Constitution. But Williams soon found himself labeled an enemy of the state by the federal government. Why?
That's what I went looking after. And what I saw, what I found, was that the depth of anti-Blackness in this nation, the description of Black people as dangerous, as a threat, as there to overtake, overturn, and demolish whites in this society, has led to the rise of the Second Amendment, led to the rise of the militia, and has consistently sought to undermine African Americans' access to guns, because Black is the threat. And so Blacks with guns becomes the exponential threat. And what we see is that, yes, there is this long tradition of gun ownership for Blacks in the South, for hunting and for defense. But what we see historically is that so-called right to self-defense does not include Black people. When Black people have tried to defend themselves, generally, they have been met with disproportionate state power or disproportionate mob power backed by the state, sanctioned by the state, approved and okayed by the state, that has led to no accountability for the slaughter of Black people who were trying to defend themselves.
Indeed, not only that the state is doing this, but that the state itself is created based on this, that you walk us back to the founding and really change our understanding, I think, of what the entire Bill of Rights is, but particularly the Second Amendment. So tell me, why is the Second, as you write, so inherently and structurally flawed, so based on Black exclusion and debasement, that unlike the other amendments, it can never be a pathway to civil and human rights? Why is the Second so much more flawed than, say, I don't know, the Fifth, which also nobody was thinking about us when they wrote?
Right. And it's because the point of the Second, the baseline reason for the Second, was the control of Black people, the subjugation of Black people, to take away Black people's rights. And so let me walk us through that history. We had the Constitutional Convention, where you had the South playing some serious hardball with the Northern delegates about this founding document, this Constitution of the United States. And this is how we got the 3/5 clause. This is how we got the 20-year extension on the Atlantic slave trade, and how we got the Fugitive Slave Clause. Well, when it came down time for ratification, Virginia was playing just real serious hardball. Virginia, a massive slave state. Patrick Henry was worried 8 ways to Sunday that James Madison, also a Virginian and a slave owner, had put control of the militia under the federal government in the Constitution. Patrick Henry and George Mason were arguing strenuously that you could not trust the federal government to protect slave owners against a slave revolt. You could not trust those folks from Pennsylvania and from Massachusetts to call in the militia when the slaves would revolt. We will be left defenseless, is what Mason said. And so they began playing serious hardball with Madison, saying that they would basically scuttle the Constitution, that they would push for a new constitutional convention unless they got that protection. That protection was the Bill of Rights. And that protection, when you think about it, you get freedom of the press, freedom of speech, the right not to be illegally searched and seized, the right to not have to incriminate yourself, the right to a speedy and fair trial, the right to not to have cruel and unusual punishment. And then you get this, the rights of a well-regulated militia shall not be, for the security of the state. Wow, that thing is an outlier. And it reads like an outlier because it is the bribe paid to the South to secure the United States of America. And so in the Bill of Rights, we have a right to clamp down on the rights of Black people. That was the role of the militia.
Okay, now walk forward for me to our more contemporary moment, because also in this text, you tie together mass incarceration, disenfranchisement of those who have served time for a felony, and this Second Amendment for which you've just given us this colonial history. Tell us how these three things, the Second, mass incarceration, and felon disenfranchisement, are connected.
They all deal with issues of citizenship. They all deal with the ways that the state has been deployed in an anti-blackness frame to dissipate, to clamp down on, to subjugate black political power, black voices, black humanity. And so this assault on the criminalization of blackness that has led to mass incarceration has in there, we've got legislation that says that felons cannot own weapons. When you have a skewed criminal justice system that criminalizes blackness, and we know that we had statutes that were only applied against black people. We've had disparate sentencing, disparate policing, the hyper policing in the black community that generates this false narrative of inherent black criminality. So when you have statutes that say, if you have a felony conviction, you cannot own a weapon, that is creating a disproportionate burden on the black community. And we also have felon disenfranchisement, where those who have a felony conviction cannot vote. And we have some states like Florida, for instance, that had permanent felony disenfranchisement. And so this is a way of silencing black people, a way of debasing and devaluing black humanity, black people's rights.
I want to get a little intersectional for a moment, because there's one way of thinking about and imagining, like I think about the fact that the shotgun on the back of my office door was given to me by my father, who typically does think in terms of, like, you know, fairly traditional, man shall protect home against invading white folks, right? That's definitely how my dad sees the world, having grown up in the Jim Crow South, right? So he comes by that honestly. It's also true that I simply do know the data that say that as a woman living in a home with a firearm, I am substantially more likely to be shot and killed by my domestic partner, by my husband, by a man who's in my household, than I am to use that weapon to protect myself from someone outside the household. Is there a way that Black women and Black men have maybe needed to think about both being armed and about self-defense in ways that are distinct?
One of the things that I really stress in this book is that this isn't a pro-gun or an anti-gun book. This is about Black people's rights. And part of that is the way that we begin to reconceptualize what safety and security really looks like. And so what we know, you know, I tell the story, for instance, of Marissa Alexander in this book, who was a Black woman who had was a victim of domestic violence, and her then husband was attacking her once again. She runs, she gets her gun, she shoots a bullet in the air as a warning shot to get him to back off, as he says, so I wouldn't put my hands on her again, no more. And this was in a stand your ground state, and she was convicted and sentenced to 20 years.
By the same prosecutor, right? Not just in a stand your ground state, but literally in the same county where George Zimmerman had gotten off for killing a teenager who was unarmed. She shoots a ceiling tile and gets more time.
Yes, yes. So to me, the issue is the precarity of Black life, that what we have here with anti-Blackness is the devaluation of Black humanity. And seeing what that means, where Marissa Alexander cannot defend herself from a man who has put her in the hospital before. And her baby was only 9 days old at the time that this happened. That you get her being prosecuted and imprisoned, and George Zimmerman walking for shooting an unarmed teenager after he had stalked this child with a loaded weapon in a community. I mean, this is the precarity of Black life that really I want coming through in this book.
When I think about what it means that the state took Marissa Alexander from her still nursing brand new infant baby.
Yes, Lord.
The sadness, and I know Marissa just enough, right? I've talked to her just enough times, just the brutality, the cruelty of it. And we're in a public moment when we're being told that we can't know stories like this because it will separate us from the love of America. That if we know this, if we know this history about the establishment of the Second Amendment, if we understand this story about the state of Florida versus Zimmerman versus Marissa Alexander, that we will cease to be patriots.
Well, one, this massive pushback that we're having now in these state legislatures that call identifying and teaching the ways that race and racism works in the United States as divisive, but they're not calling white supremacy divisive. They're calling the bringing out of these stories, of the role of slavery, of the role of Jim Crow, of the role of these massacres like Tulsa, like Colfax, Louisiana in 1873, like Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898, that if we don't know this history, then somehow we'll be patriots, is not to understand that we had fathers who came through Jim Crow. We had grandfathers who came through slavery or great-grandfathers, and they were patriots. They were willing to put their lives on the line for this nation, knowing what it is. If your patriotism is dependent upon whitewashing American history, you are not a patriot.
Mm. And with that, Carol Anderson is author of The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. She's also Charles Howard Candler, Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. Thank you for joining me, Professor Anderson.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Hope y'all enjoyed today's show, and that's all we have for you, but don't worry, we'll be back for more tomorrow. Remember, you can be part of the show by calling us with show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.